November 26, 2008, Karachi, Pakistan. 10 men gathered at a small harbor. They lowered a small wooden boat into the Arabian Sea, climbed aboard, and motored towards a fishing vessel on the horizon. As they drew up alongside, the captain headed up on the deck to see what was going on. The 10 men murdered the crew and forced the captain to change course, setting sail for Mumbai. Formerly known as Bombay, Mumbai is the largest, richest, and most populous city in India. Their intent was to mercilessly massacre innocent people throughout the city in carefully coordinated terror strikes.
Only one side had the guns, the baddies had the guns, the goodies had nothing.
This was India's 9/11.
Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top secret military operations.
These were some extremely, extremely motivated and brave men.
The NSG is a highly specialized force, designed and structured on the lines of some of the world's key anti-terrorism special units like the SAS, GSG-9, and has a certain components which have been picked up from others.
I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special forces missions to learn about the brave soldiers who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
So the floor was just covered in thick blood.
When the city of Mumbai was under sudden, constant attack, India's elite force took a stand to protect its people. But with well-trained enemies and little time to prepare, it wouldn't be easy.
You can't use maximum force. It has to be precise force.
The dramatic story of Operation Black Tornado. Mumbai is the richest and most populated city in India. It prides itself on its Western influence and rich culture. Tim Reed was doing business in the city in early November 2008 and sets the scene.
I'd flown in that morning from Delhi. It was an early morning flight, so I was a little bit red-eyed and tired. Spent the day battling through the city to various meetings, driving around, and then finally got to the hotel that night, exhausted. Mumbai is a busy, crazy, hectic, wild place, absolute assault on the senses. You know, the noise. I like going out running quite often, and I've never really gone out to other cities where I have to run over dogs and people sleeping on the street and all kinds of obstacles. So it's a very entertaining place to go to.
Mumbai, to Americans, is considered a wealthy city, home to Bollywood, home to luxury, be it luxury hotels, luxury boutiques, home to backpackers, but it's considered a very wealthy city, an investment city.
That's Amy Gutman, a veteran reporter. She was with CBS News Bureau in London as the terrorists made their way to Mumbai. Around 8:30 p.m., the fishing boat carrying the militants arrived at the shore of Mumbai, not far from the heart of the city. Now, at their destination, they killed the captain and stepped onto shore. The men were all heavily armed and carrying enough rounds and bombs for days of fighting. To everyone else in the city center, the evening was like any other, bustling with tourists and getting busier as the locals hit the streets for after-work activities. A short walk from the waterfront, British tourist Harnish Patel was enjoying a few drinks with a friend at the world-famous Leopold Cafe.
I was in India in 2008 on the way back to the UK for Christmas. Leopold Cafe is a very popular bar, cafe, where a lot of Westerners, locals and tourists meet for food and drink. I recall from walking into the bar, it was completely packed, and we were taken to a seat, which is pretty much at the back of the cafe, nowhere to move, no escape route, nowhere obvious.
Not long after, local journalist Sourav Mishra arrived on the scene to meet up with friends.
My friends, Kate and Clementine, they were waiting outside the cafe. And at 8:30 we made there, and we said, let's get in. It's always crowded, so you don't find places to sit. So we had to wait a while, then we got a place. And there are quite a few pillars, I think three or four pillars inside. So we were sitting next to one of the pillars. And we had a normal Leopold cafe food, the beer.
It seemed like a pleasant, normal evening out, until Mishra noticed two visitors acting strangely. They didn't appear to be at the Leopold to socialize.
They seemed out of place to me. After a while, I see there is this guy who's sitting in front of me, another table, and his friends are all laughing. Suddenly I see there is some sort of cracker or some fire is coming out on his table. So I thought probably it's his birthday, people are celebrating. Then I see he's flung up behind and the food and everything is shattered. Then, you know, I just hear ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta and then something hits me.
I knew something wasn't quite right when I heard a gunshot and what sounded like a lot of glass dropping at once.
Two gunmen were firing AK-47s from the doorways, spraying the cafe with bullets. Harnish took shelter under the small cafe table.
I had a lot of shouting and screaming, people rushing around. At that point, I looked either side and it clearly, I recall from walking into the bar, it was completely packed, and we were no escape route, nowhere obvious. The only exit that I was aware of was through the entrance. We hadn't been in that long, didn't know where the toilets or any of the exits were. So literally, it was just locked down. Just braced myself and not move or make any sound.
Surav, meanwhile, had turned away from his conversation, wondering what all the commotion was about, when something hit his arm. It took a minute for it to sink in.
I said, oh my God, is something happening around? Why people are running, you know? Then I ran. When I came out of the door, I realized there's something which is holding me back. Then I see that blood is going out of my body. We had to run about a kilometer to Regal Cinema, where we got a taxi, and that taxi guy took us to the hospital.
Surav was bleeding, but was still able to move. He had been among the lucky able to escape the Leopold Cafe. Harnish, meanwhile, was still trapped inside.
There were a lot of bodies. The floor was just covered in thick blood, and there were a number of bodies. Indian and Westerners that had been injured and all just not moving. Everything went silent. At that point, still didn't move because I was unsure what the situation was. And then I heard suddenly what sounded like another round. Clearly the guy was reloading. And then what I'm assuming is he may have been shooting at bodies on the floor, maybe other people just sort of curled up on the floor. And it's during that round that I was hit in the leg. That's when I felt the thud against my left side of my body. I felt my body jerk 180 degrees and I just braced myself again, didn't move. Because if I did, there's this chance that he'd come back and finish off what he obviously intended to do.
He waited for something to happen, huddled under the table. And finally, after a sustained attack, the gunman fled into the night. The dying and wounded were left to their fate when an ambulance arrived on the scene. Harnish was brought to a hospital for treatment. Surav was lucky as well. But 10 people were killed.
Because the wound was fresh and I could be summoned to the hospital fast. That's the only reason I survived.
Across town, two more gunmen were in a taxi headed for the crowded central railway station. Reports started to come through that there was an incident developing in Mumbai. CBS News journalist Amy Gutman started to put together a report in London as Sutik Biswas was monitoring the event for the BBC.
The Victoria Terminus would be akin to an attack on Grand Central, which has huge significance, not just for New Yorkers, but for all Americans, for its history, for its sentimental value. It's depicted in so many films. So an attack on the main train station in a country or in a major city like Mumbai or New York, I think has strong resonance for Americans.
If you look at the station, that's the busiest station. Mumbai also has the largest suburban train network in India. So a lot of the traffic basically starts and ends at that station. Really iconic station built by the British Victorian architecture. Very Gothic looking, as you will find.
The gunman walked slowly through the crowded passenger hall. At 9:53 p.m., they pulled assault rifles from their bags and unleashed a devastating hail of bullets into the crowd. 104 people were injured and 58 killed.
We were at home, my wife and I. We were, you know, evening time, I think we just finished dinner or something. And our niece, who's with her family in Mumbai, they were leaving for a holiday for Goa, and they were at the train station.
Vikram Sood is the former head of India's Foreign Intelligence Agency.
She rang us to say that, you know, something horrible is happening here, and I think it's gang warfare. Probably it's on TV, and we're going home. So they put the phone down, and we switched on the TV, and my first reaction when I saw the shots, I told my wife, I said, this is not gang warfare. This is a terrorist attack. And this is a commando kind of, this man is well trained. He looks trained. He looks physically fit. He's got the, you know, all the paraphernalia of the rucksack and the gun and the wristwatch, all prepared for, I said, this is terrorism. And the next question was, who? I said, Lashkar. It has got to be Lashkar-e-Taiba. They are the only ones who are competent enough to do it.
The Lashkar-e-Taiba are a Pakistani terrorist organization who are influenced by the Wahhabi sect of Sunni Islam. Their aim is to establish Muslim rule over the entire Indian subcontinent, and they're willing to slaughter innocent men, women, and children to achieve that goal. Later intelligence believed that in 2008 they were funded by none other than Osama bin Laden. But on the day of the attacks, Indian intelligence was only just getting wind of the situation. Army Brigadier Venkataraman Mahalingam was oblivious to the attacks until he saw them on TV. He had been enjoying a night out with his wife when the attacks began.
Well, I didn't know anything about it till I saw things in the TV. It was the first time I was, on that day I had just gone out and got in, and my wife told me that there is something like this is happening. Switched on the TV, and then I heard that the commandos of the Navy were taking some action. And initially I never expected the whole thing to be of this enormity. And thereafter, then slowly things started unfolding itself.
And another intelligence officer was watching the horror unfold and planning retaliation. Maruf Raza was the director general of India's elite counterterrorism unit, the Black Cats.
To me, it became clear in the very beginning itself that it was a terrorist attack. What took people by surprise was the fact that the way Mumbai was chosen and the high-profile southern Mumbai business district was chosen. But the rest of the modus operandi of the people who were involved in the attack left no shade of doubt, at least in my mind, that this was a terrorist attack orchestrated from India's neighborhood, very clearly designed to put India on the back foot and show India as an unsafe destination for people to come out and do business in because of India's economic rise.
With the second attack on the train station, it was clear that this was only the beginning. Mumbai was under a sustained terrorist attack. But in the moment, No one knew for sure who was behind it or where they might strike next. Millions watched as the events unfolded live across India's news networks. Seeing the carnage, Jyoti Krishan Dutt, the Director General of India's elite National Security Guard, ordered his commandos to stand by. The National Security Guard, also known as the NSG, are nicknamed the Black Cats because of their distinctive all-black uniforms. They were the ideal unit for this kind of situation. Maruf Raza again.
The National Security Guard was set up around the mid-1980s when India actually first faced the threat of urban terror, and which would specifically be trained, equipped to handle the role of counter-terrorism.
Like Britain's Special Air Service and Germany's GSG9, the Black Cats are a specialized unit built for extreme circumstances. They are experts in counter-terrorism, counter-hijacking, and hostage rescue. Indian Army Brigadier Venkataraman Mahalingam explains what sets them apart.
You see, the men are all drawn from the Indian Army. They are all infantry soldiers who have been recruited into the army, gone through their basic infantry training, and thereafter they have joined their respective units, and they've had anything from 5 to 8 years of service they have gone through. And after that, they're hand-picked by their respective commanding officers, and they are sent to the NSG training center. We have an NSG training center as well. When they reach there, they are put through a screening test, which includes their physical fitness, their firing standards, and also their psychological makeup. These things are gone through, and thereafter a selection of a few people are made, and they are put through 13 weeks of intense training. Once their training is over, they are tested again, and only those who qualify, they are taken out, and they are sent to different units. The two units, basically one is the counter-terrorism unit, and the other one the counter-hijack unit.
All recruits are put through a rigorous screening process, assessing physical fitness, shooting standards, and psychological profiling. Serving soldiers Maruf Raza, Colonel Chandrawat, and Brigadier Mahalingam explain what it takes to become part of the force.
So largely, they pick up people, firstly, who have very good physical attributes. They look at people who have commando mindsets, and therefore are willing to do the unusual, be put through unusual hours of training and unusual demands on them, even at the cost of their lives. They look for people who are out of the box.
Special operations training, like for example, room shooting practices, building interventions, bus intervention, metro intervention, and in my case, in my unit's case, counter-hijack training. And bomb disposal training.
They are daredevils, they are first-rate troops, and I can vouch for that.
Certainly, the Black Cats seemed prepared to be able to take on anything. How would they respond to a gang of well-armed, committed terrorists spread out across India's busiest city? But the most immediate hindrance was waiting for permission to be deployed. News of the incident still hadn't even spread outside of India. Amy Gutman was in the CBS News Bureau in London when reports came through that there was an incident developing in Mumbai.
So we're always looking for breaking news, always keeping an eye out. And I remember it was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, which is typically a very quiet news day in America. So often on days like that, either the day before a holiday or on holidays, working for a U.S. Network, very often our news editors in New York will look to the foreign bureaus for sources of news because there's a skeleton staff operating in the States. And again, there's not a lot really going on. Everybody's sort of checking out for the holiday. And it just happened to be one of those days.
In the newsroom, Amy began seeing reports that Mumbai was under attack.
I know photographers were on the ground, were racing all over. And instantly we started getting feeds from the various agencies. Sky was reporting on the story, BBC was reporting on the story, and we were starting to parse it out. Our response generally to these things is to get on the phone instantly with New York to flag them, because in many cases when there's a big breaking news event, they will make a decision to either interrupt regular programming or run what we call an on-screen crawl.
Amy, the other news correspondents, and officials watched as events unfolded. The Leopold Cafe had been hit, and the main train station. Now there were reports of gunfire at a local hospital and police station. Time bombs left in taxis by the terrorists detonated in different parts of the city. Reports were already coming in that 74 people had been killed and 147 wounded. At this stage, the authorities had no idea what was going on or what to do about it. Instead, the best intelligence was from social media.
It was really the first time that Twitter played a very big role in our news coverage and our reaction. People who were posting links to pictures, to cell phone images.
Twitter and Facebook messages were coming in droves about hearing bombs, seeing chaos. From the sheer number of messages, the real scale of the attacks was obvious, and there was panic on the ground. But with so much conflicting information, it was impossible for the authorities to figure out an accurate intelligence landscape. Sutik Biswas, BBC's India correspondent, was also monitoring the unfolding events in shock.
I remember it was an evening when there was a cricket match between India and England being played. And England was getting a hammering in that series, I think. And so we were very happy, and I was planning dinner when at 9:30 exactly, I remember, I got a text message from a journalist friend in Delhi that there was a little gang attack outside the Leopold Cafe in Mumbai. But I remember how it kind of escalated, because within 25 minutes, I got another text message from the same friend saying that it looks much more serious. I think within one hour, 15 minutes, I was absolutely sure that this was a huge story, possibly the biggest terror attack in India. Yeah, I think by within a couple of hours, I remember by 11:30, we were absolutely sure that this is huge. This is huge, this is a big terror attack. Decided to move a huge crew to Bombay, at least about half a dozen people, I think, left next morning, producers, reporters, cameramen. We took the first flight. I remember it was an early morning flight, 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. Indian Airlines, full of the media, some grieving relatives.
Another BBC correspondent, Mark Dumet, was scrambling to the scene of the attacks as well.
It was stunning. It was shocking that something like this could have been going on.
Media from all over the world were assembling on the scene, drawing attention to the fact that Indian authorities were still at a standstill. Civilians, journalists, and bloggers alike were sharing real-time information on social media, making it one of the most well-documented terrorist attacks in history. It later became clear that grabbing worldwide attention was a key part of the terrorists' plan.
It was meant to last a long time. It was meant to attract the attention of the world.
I think the timing played perfectly into a Western news schedule in terms of hitting at a time of day when it would allow people to plan their coverage so that there would be enough material and would be enough preparation time for people to get people in place and put together a story.
Remember, it happens at night in Delhi and in Mumbai. It's daytime in New York. It's daytime on Capitol Hill. And it is also daytime in London.
119 people had already been killed and 315 wounded. And it looked to the world as though the Indian government had lost control of the situation. Over 600 miles away, in Delhi, the Black Cat Commandos were on standby, waiting to deploy. But they were powerless to intervene until the Director General, J.K. Dutt, was given direct orders to launch a counter-terror operation. And in Mumbai, the situation was escalating. 2 hours into the attacks, the terrorists targeted one of India's most famous hotels, the Oberoi Trident. Within sat British businessman Tim Reed, enjoying a meal.
I was staying in the Oberoi Hotel, which is on Nariman Point. I guess it's the what has been always the commercial centre of Mumbai. And the Oberoi Hotel is one of the kind of long-standing upmarket, I guess, hotels. And it's, you know, it's a nice place to stay. I had been eating in the restaurant. I remember I was reading, and it just so happened that I finished the book just as the waiter came up to ask if I wanted some coffee. And I said, no, I've, you know, finished my book. I'm going to go now. Let me pay the bill.
Tim paid the waiter and stood up to leave.
I left the restaurant, looked, it was on the mezzanine level of the hotel, so it was overlooking the lobby. I looked over my left shoulder into the lobby, and everything was moving in slow motion. It's a little bit like when you fall off your bike and you fly through the air and imagine what pain lies ahead of you. And I didn't hear any gunshots. I didn't see what was happening. I could just see people running in a very strange way, and things blurred and a tunnel vision view of what was happening. It was a couple of, maybe a second, well, what seemed like a number of seconds later, but possibly a split second later, that I heard some gunshots and saw people running up the staircase. That was when I realized that something fairly bad was happening.
Tim didn't know just how bad it was. Not only was the Oberoi under attack, but a mile away, the Taj Palace Hotel was also seeing gunfire. One of the city's greatest landmarks, the Taj Palace Hotel, not only has hundreds of suites, it's the local gathering spot for celebrities, royalty, and rock stars. An attack on such a landmark building would have major consequences around the world.
The two hotels, they're landmarks that attract a lot of people. This is why these were all considered very soft targets. You get a lot of bang for your buck. You get locals and you get big international crowds. More specifically, you get Americans, you get Brits. And we know that that was really the goal here, was not just to send a message to the Indians, but also to send a wider message to the international community.
Back at the Oberoi, Tim Reed had left the restaurant, still unsure what was happening. And then he heard gunshots.
So when I heard the gunshots, my first reaction was that it was a lone gunman who was randomly shooting on people, or maybe a spurned lover come to take revenge. I actually had that thought for a reasonably long time. So at that point I thought, wow, I'm living through one of these gun things you hear about on TV, and you know, I'll be able to tell people at home about this. It's only when you realize that you are actually a participant in this event that you start feeling scared about it. And at that point, both my legs were shaking uncontrollably. And I was sort of holding onto a pillar, really hoping that I didn't die, and thinking about what I'd done in my life up to now, and whether in that classic life flirting in front of your eyes, you know, do I regret anything? Should I have done things differently? I think when I heard the gunfire go continuously for a number of seconds, possibly even a minute, I realised that you know, there's going to be a lot of victims to this. But when you first see the people falling, there was no noise. So when the gunmen, when I saw them coming and shooting people downstairs, I backed to against the corridor.
To Tim's horror, there was nowhere for him to hide. At the end of the hall were several elevators, but reaching them would put him in full view of the terrorists. Then he saw something.
And there really wasn't anywhere. There was a slight recess that I was able to hide in. But literally, if I'd been any more than my 11, 12 stone, my stomach would probably have been poking out from that. So there really wasn't very much much room for cover. Then I heard the gunfire getting closer and closer, and it was obvious they were coming up the stairs where I'd watched the people being hit. They came up the stairs, and I looked back into the restaurant that I'd just come from, and at that point the head waiter closed the doors and locked everyone into the restaurant. So I was the only person on the mezzanine, and everyone else was in the restaurant. So the gunman came closer and started shooting at the glass door. At that point, they must have been, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet from where I was, but they weren't looking for me. They were looking at the restaurant. They shot a surveillance camera that was positioned above the door of the restaurant. So they'd obviously scoped the place out pretty well beforehand. And everyone in the restaurant was screaming and running everywhere. And I fully expected them to keep walking and then look to their left, see me, and shoot me. And I was wondering how it would feel to be shot and if it would be sort of quick and easily over. And I think of all the times in the whole incident, this was the only bit where I actively contributed. I was a participant who was in charge of what was happening. And that was by looking out from my hiding place, confirming that they were shooting the other way, then desperately looking for some way of getting out. And there was a lift between myself and where the gunmen were. So I was able to reach out and touch the call lift button, and then go back into my hiding place. I was waiting for that ping as the elevator comes up. I then sneaked into the elevator, and as I hit the closed door button about 2,000 times in quick succession, trying to keep the door closed. At that point, I then rang my wife to tell her what was happening.
Scenes from the attacks were being broadcast to televisions around the world. The Taj Palace Hotel was ablaze. Mumbai's greatest landmark had been set on fire, the rising flames sending a clear message. Nowhere was safe.
I think the image that's burned into everyone's mind of this incident, of this event, is that of the Taj Palace Hotel and the flames coming through the roof.
Whenever anybody talks of Mumbai terror, this is the shot. Taj on fire.
It spread fear across the international community, certainly within the US, the UK, and Israel, for Jews around the world. So from a social perspective, the fear factor was very high, which is always one of the very first goals of these kinds of attacks.
Mumbai's first line of defense was the local police force, but such a coordinated attack exceeded their training. They were overwhelmed and at a loss.
And some of the senior policemen had been caught up in the violence, and the head of the anti-terrorism squad from Mumbai had been shot dead.
When you are dealing with, you know, hardcore, highly motivated terrorists who are willing to die and who have been well-trained, well-equipped, they know exactly what they're doing, it is difficult to, you know, handle those guys if you're a normal policeman.
Until the Black Cats were given the go-ahead, the only special forces on hand were a few units from the locally based Marine Commandos, the Marcos. The best Marcos could do was contain the situation and surround the hotels, but they were not equipped or trained to take down the terrorists inside.
The naval commandos are not meant to operate in these situations. They are for a different purpose altogether. Militants had the freedom to move anywhere inside the hotel.
With the city's police outgunned, the terrorists continued with impunity. The hotels were full of high-profile businessmen and VIPs, giving them the possibility of extremely high-profile hostages. In the Oberoi, British businessman Tim Reed was caught in the middle of the action. He realized that the elevators he escaped into only went to the lower three floors, where the gunmen were in full control.
I knew that the gunmen had come in via the lobby. I knew that I was on the mezzanine and they were there too. So the lower lobby didn't seem like a great place to go to either. So I tried to stay in the lift by pressing closed door. But the closed door button is overridden by the call lift button, which someone in the lower lobby had pressed. So we went down there and I prepared myself, i.e. sat shivering in the corner, nothing like James Bond at all, prepared myself for who was going to come in. It turns out it was a waiter, an Indian waiter, and he really was in a state of complete panic and alarm. He jumped into the lift and immediately pressed the lobby button, which I knew wasn't a great decision given that the gunmen were in the lobby. So we prepared to go up. I kept pressing the closed door button, but that sadly isn't a strategy that works. So the doors opened on the lobby, and we prepared for the doors to open and be greeted by the sights of lots of gunmen. But actually the lift, fortunately, opens onto a corner of the lobby. All we could hear was the gunfire and screaming, but we couldn't see anybody. So we quickly pressed the closed door button, and then I thought about what the options were. The strategy ended up, let's go for the lower lobby. So we pressed lower lobby on the lift button, and then when the doors opened, we just ran. And I think this moment is the one that I recall most in, not dreams, but in, you know, recollections or, you know, things that make me think back to the incident. It's that feeling of running, not knowing where you're going, hearing gunfire behind you, not knowing if at any moment you might, you know, feel that pain and fall to the ground. And I think that is really probably the abiding memory, the one that haunts me probably more than any other. Because, you know, you're running and you just don't know what's behind you. You can hear a lot of things. So we ran through what seemed like endless corridors and finally got to a little room where the chauffeurs work. And the chauffeurs were completely oblivious to everything that was happening. They offered me a glass of water. We heard a grenade go off. And at that point, we all decided that it was really safer to get out of the hotel. So we ran out of the hotel, into the street through a back passage of the hotel, and there were thousands of people in the street running one way, and then, you know, with that sort of human curiosity, going back the way they came just to see what happened, and then running again. There were rumours that there was something else happening at the Taj Hotel. Then a couple of more grenades went off in the Oberoi, and I started running.
Tim was finally safe, but there were still hundreds of people in the Oberoi, and the terrorists were freely killing innocent civilians. Back in Delhi, Maruf Raza, the director general of the Black Cats, was keenly aware of the developments, impatiently watching the unfolding scenes on TV. When would the government give them authorization to deploy?
There was a reluctance on the part of the government in Mumbai to first come to terms with the level of attack that was taking place.
90 minutes after the attacks began, with 83 people confirmed dead, the phone finally rang. The formal request came in from the Ministry of Home Affairs just before midnight on November 26. The Black Cats were given the green light. 200 NSG troops prepared for battle. The elite fighters spent years training for this day, but no one was prepared for what lay ahead. A 3-day firefight against battle-hardened, organized, and determined killers.
They had this operation meticulously planned months in advance. They had done lots of recces, sending people in and out. Just the very fact that they were able to send so many people in and out from Pakistan, which should be an obvious question mark for anybody tracking their movements, which clearly no one was.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production, hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley and Rachel Jacobs, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had editing help by David Markowitz, with additional production from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa and Damian Thorpe. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.